There's this specific musical sequence. It's just a handful of notes, really, that for about 800 years has been used to signal death. You hear it in The Shining, you hear it in the darkest moments of Star Wars, and if you listen really closely to the opening whistle of the show we're covering today, you can hear it just screaming at you right from the very start.
The Dies Irae, the Day of Wrath.
Exactly.
It's a medieval Latin chant about Judgment Day,
Yes.
and it is the absolute DNA of the score we're unpacking today.
Today, we are doing a deep dive into Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. But we aren't just looking at the plot, because let's be honest, most people know the basics.
Oh, yeah.
A barber slits throats, the landlady bakes him into pies. It's a great campfire story.
Right.
But looking through the sources we've pulled, what's so fascinating is that this isn't just a horror story. It's really a battleground between two very different ideas of what the show is even about.
That's it. Is it a story about the Industrial Revolution just crushing the working class? Or is it a psychological thriller about one man's internal, mental breakdown?
Yes. We've got notes here on the original 1979 production.
Yeah.
They used an actual iron foundry on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And there were conflicting views between the director and the composer. And we'll get into the evolution of the show from this massive black operetta
Yeah.
to, well, to people eating actual meat pies while the cast screams at them.
It is a wild trajectory, and I think to really understand why Sweeney Todd is considered a masterpiece and not just a gimmick, we have to start with that identity crisis.
Okay, so where do we start?
Well, Sondheim himself called it a black operetta.
Which, I mean, that feels like a fancy way of saying a musical where everyone dies,
Yeah.
but it's more technical than that, isn't it?
It is, yeah. A standard musical usually has a book, spoken dialogue that's interspersed with the songs.
Right.
Sweeney Todd is about 80% sung through. The music, it rarely stops. It underscores the dialogue, it creates the tension, it even creates the sound effects.
So it's closer to opera.
It's much closer to Puccini than it is to, say, Oklahoma. And in fact, it's been performed by the Houston Grand Opera and the New York City Opera.
But unlike opera, which is so often about this grand romantic tragedy, this is gritty. It's nasty. And the origin of the character really reflects that. Before Sondheim ever touched this, Sweeney Todd was basically an urban legend in Victorian London.
He was the boogeyman.
Yeah.
The character first appeared in a penny dreadful, a serial called The String of Pearls, way back in the winter of 1846.
I love that term, penny dreadful. It sounds exactly like what it is.
And it was very effective. You have to remember the context of London in the 1840s. The population was exploding, people were disappearing,
Right.
and there was a genuine pervasive fear about what was actually in the meat pies people were buying on the street.
So the story played on a literal culinary anxiety, like, is this beef or is this my neighbor?
Precisely. But in that original version, Sweeney Todd was just a cartoon villain. He murdered people for their money, their string of pearls, literally.
So just greed, no real motive.
None. He was just a cackling psychopath. And if the character had stayed like that, we wouldn't be talking about him today.
So the pivot point, it seems from our research, is 1970. A playwright named Christopher Bond writes a new version of the play. And this is where the character gets his soul.
Bond did something absolutely brilliant. He looked at this cheap slasher villain and decided to give him the motivation of a Jacobean tragedy.
The Jacobean tragedy, okay.
He turned Sweeney Todd into Benjamin Barker, a man who was wrongfully exiled by a corrupt judge who wanted to rape Barker's wife.
Wow, that changes the entire temperature of the narrative.
Completely.
He's not killing for money anymore. He's killing for retribution. He's Monte Cristo with a razor.
And Bond signaled this shift in a very specific way. He wrote some of the dialogue in blank verse.
Like Shakespeare.
Exactly. When you give a character iambic rhythm, you are telling the audience, treat this man with the same gravity you would treat Hamlet or Macbeth.
You elevate him.
You elevate him from the gutter to the tragic stage. And that is what Stephen Sondheim saw at the Theatre Royal Stratford East in 1973. He didn't see a penny dreadful. He saw a man of tragic stature being destroyed by his own obsession.
So Sondheim takes this high art, tragic structure and decides to score it. And we have to go back to the music because this is where the deep dive gets really interesting. You mentioned the Dies Irae. How does Sondheim actually use it?
It's everywhere. The most obvious place is the Ballad of Sweeney Todd. You know the melody.
Swing your razor wide, Sweeney. Hold it to the skies.
That melody is a variation of the Dies Irae chant.
So the Day of Wrath theme is literally the character's theme song.
It is, but he inverts it. He speeds it up. He even turns it into a major key for the character of Anthony, the romantic lead. It's this musical anchor that subconsciously tells you doom is coming.
It sounds like something Bernard Herrmann would do in a film score.
I'm so glad you brought him up. That was intentional. Sondheim was a huge fan of Herrmann's score for Hangover Square and, of course, Psycho.
You can hear it, especially when the factory whistle blows. It's straight out of Psycho.
He used those harsh, angular dissonances. In a normal musical, you want the harmony to resolve to feel like you're home. In Sweeney Todd, the music is constantly unsettled.
It keeps you anxious.
It keeps the audience in a state of high anxiety, which puts you right inside Sweeney's fracturing mind.
Which makes the comedic moments even more jarring. We have to talk about Mrs. Lovett, because on paper, she's a monster. She's the one who suggests, hey, let's bake these bodies into pies.
Right.
But when you watch the show, she's kind of charming.
That is the Angela Lansbury effect. When Sondheim first pitched the show to her, she didn't want to do it.
Really?
Yeah, she felt the role was just a supporting part to the barber. So to woo her, Sondheim promised her a music hall character, someone with a bit of vaudeville to her.
And that contrast is just vital, isn't it? If she were just as grim as Sweeney, the show would be unwatchable.
It would be a dirge. Lansbury played her as dotty, chaotic, and almost motherly. She normalized the horror.
And the masterpiece of that dynamic is the end of Act One. You have the song Epiphany, where Sweeney completely snaps.
Oh, it's terrifying.
That's the moment where he decides we all deserve to die.
He's screaming at the audience, threatening to kill them.
And immediately after that primal scream, Sondheim drops us into A Little Priest.
And what kind of song is A Little Priest?
It's a waltz.
Yeah.
A nice, lilting 3/4 time waltz.
It's so civilized.
Exactly. A waltz is seductive. So you have these two characters plotting mass murder and cannibalism, but they're doing it to a charming dance beat. They're making puns.
The trouble with poet is, how do you know it? It's likely to be insipid. The history of the world, my sweet, is who gets eaten, who gets to eat. It's satire on class. They're literally eating the upper crust.
And that's the trap Sondheim sets. As an audience member, you find yourself laughing.
Mm-hmm.
You're tapping your foot to a song about grinding people into meat. The show makes you complicit in the crime.
You aren't just watching the monsters. You're enjoying their company.
That idea of class brings us to the visual side of things.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned that debate about what the show is about. The original director, Hal Prince, had a very specific, very massive vision for the 1979 premiere.
Hal Prince was a genius at the concept musical. He looked at Sweeney Todd and didn't just see a revenge story. He saw a metaphor for the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
He saw Sweeney as a product of a system that chews people up, just like the meat grinder.
So he built a literal factory on stage.
He did. The set designer, Eugene Lee, actually went to Rhode Island, dismantled an old iron foundry, and reassembled it on Broadway.
No way.
It was this oppressive mountain of steel and glass. The actors were just dwarfed by it. And the ensemble played these soulless factory workers, constantly moving scenery.
It sounds incredible, but I also read that Sondheim wasn't entirely on board with that interpretation.
He wasn't. Sondheim saw the show as an intimate story about obsession. For him, Sweeney's breakdown wasn't about the industrial age. It was about a specific trauma.
He felt the factory was just layered on top.
Exactly. He felt it was something Prince layered on top of the text. It's the classic macro versus micro debate. Prince is looking at the sociology, the class war.
And Sondheim is looking at the psychology, the man's soul.
And what's fascinating about the show's history is watching how that debate played out in future productions.
Mm.
Because for a long time, people thought, you can't do Sweeney Todd without the factory. You need the spectacle.
But then came the Teeny Todd revival in 1989.
Right. They stripped it all away. Small cast, minimal set. And guess what?
It worked.
It worked even better. Without the giant iron structures, the focus zeroed in on the actor's eyes. The horror became personal, not environmental.
And that trend really peaked with the John Doyle revival in 2005. That's one where the actors played their own instruments, right?
That production was set in a mental asylum. The whole concept was that the inmates were performing the story. So you had Patti LuPone playing the tuba while playing Mrs. Lovett.
Oh, wow.
Michael Cerveris played the guitar as Sweeney.
That sounds like it could be a gimmick, but the reviews said people found it terrifying.
Because it emphasized the madness. The music wasn't coming from an orchestra pit. It was coming from inside the characters. It made the schizophrenic quality of the score visible.
And then you have the ultimate removal of the fourth wall with the Tooting Arts Club production in 2014.
This is the one that blows my mind.
The pie shop one.
They performed it in an actual operating pie shop in London, Harrington's Pie and Mash Shop.
So the audience sat at the tables. You could order a pie.
You could order a meat pie before the show. The actors were climbing over the counters, standing on the tables.
Talk about complicity. I mean, it's one thing to laugh at a little priest in a velvet theater seat. It's another thing to be holding a fork full of pie while a maniac is waving a razor inches from your face.
It collapses the distance completely.
Yeah.
It forces you to inhabit the same grimy, desperate world as the characters. It just proves that Sondheim was right. The show doesn't need a foundry.
The horror is in the intimacy. But regardless of the set factory or pie shop, the story always hurtles toward that same devastating ending. And we have to talk about the twist, because it's not just a gotcha moment, it's the entire point of the tragedy.
It is the moment where the revenge tragedy structure just snaps shut. Throughout the show, we have the beggar woman.
Right, she's always there, annoying, crude.
Always asking for alms, sexualizing the men. Sweeney just dismisses her. He finds her to be just another piece of London trash.
And in the rush to finally kill the judge, he slits her throat just to get her out of the way. You're in my light, get out.
And then, only after the adrenaline fades, he looks at her face in the glow of the oven, and he realizes it's Lucy.
His wife.
His wife. The woman he spent 15 years trying to avenge. He didn't recognize her because his obsession had blinded him to everything except his one target.
That is the ultimate irony. In trying to be her savior, he became her executioner.
And that just destroys him. He allows Tobias, the simple boy who has now been driven insane by discovering the bodies, to kill him. The cycle completes itself.
Everyone dies.
Total annihilation.
It's so bleak. But strangely, the show ends with the cast coming back out and singing the ballad again. And there's that line, to hold up a mirror.
To hold up a mirror. It's the most important line in the whole show.
So what are they asking us to see in that mirror? Because I'd like to think I'm not a serial killer barber.
Hopefully not. But the mirror isn't about the murder. It's about the impulse. The show suggests that the desire for revenge, that feeling that you have been wronged and therefore you are entitled to strike back, that's universal.
It's that dog-eat-dog mentality Lovett talks about, eat or get eaten.
Exactly. Sweeney isn't some monster from outer space. He's a man who was pushed too far. The show asks, how much pushing would it take for you to snap? We live in a world of massive inequality, of industrial pressures, of systemic unfairness. The demon barber is just the extreme manifestation of the rage we all shove down.
So in a way, the Industrial Revolution metaphor and the personal obsession metaphor, they're both right.
I think so. The world creates the pressure and the individual cracks under it.
And the result is a society where we consume each other. Metaphorically, usually.
But in this show, quite literally.
Well, on that appetizing note,
yeah,
it really does change how you look at a musical that, on the surface, just seems like a Halloween spook fest.
It's a complex machine. Music, psychology, social satire. It's all in there.
It's a masterpiece that reminds us that the line between civilized society and meat pie shop is maybe thinner than we think.
A terrifying thought to take with you.
A terrifying thought for the next time you're stuck in traffic or feeling a little vengeful. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Sweeney Todd. Don't forget to check the show notes for links to the recordings we mentioned. You really do need to hear that factory whistle for yourself. We'll catch you on the next dive.